I void warranties and I'm a warning label.
Well, I mean, okay. I mean, I yell, scream, cuss, hoot, and holler. So get ready for it, because I don't have a filter. I tell everybody, like, I don't dumb this shit down for anybody.
There's your introduction to today's guest nerd. I'm just going to open the show with that. My name's Joel, and I'm a recovering nerd. I've spent the last 25 years bouncing between creative jobs and technical teams. I worked at places like Nickelodeon to NASA and a few other places that started with different letters. I was one of the first couple hundred people podcasting back in the early aughts until I accidentally became an IT analyst. Thankfully, someone in the government said, "Hey, you're a nerd that talks good." And that spun me off into the world of startups, branding, and marketing for the same sort of researchers and startup founders that I used to hang out with. Today, I help technical people learn how to get noticed, get remembered, and get results. On Nerds That Talk Good, I want to help you do the same. I talk with some of the greatest technical communicators, facilitators, and thinkers that I know who are behind the big brands and the tech talk that just works. As Chip opened us up with, this is an explicit show. We are going to be talking about some pretty hard subjects. Chip has a history as a military contractor and currently works in the operational technology space. That can include power, water, defense. So whenever anything bad happens in those areas, Chip is behind it. That's not what I mean. Chip is there to save the day. Unfortunately, when something bad happens, it can be pretty bad. The subject matters are going to involve terrorism, drugs, injuries, and that type of stuff. So if you're cool with that, stick with us. If not, I'll see you on the next one. Very excited to have Chip Harris joining today. Chip's a senior cybersecurity administrator, ethical hacker, pen tester, investigator, nerd, teacher, public speaker, cybersecurity content creator, and evangelist for cybersecurity and strategy. All of that, and ain't nobody ever seen this man's face. Because of his past career, the critical industries he helps protect, and the bad guys he exposes, Chip practices an extreme amount of OPSEC, or operational security, to protect his identity, and he is truly operating from stealth. That hasn't stopped him from being interviewed on camera, on several podcasts, being prolific on social media, and even acting as a spokes hacker for some pretty cool community stuff that's going on in the cyber community. I thought it would be really cool to have Chip on to talk about operating from stealth, how to be selective in what you share with the public, but also just how to make an impact with the information that you do share. Chip, buddy, this is awesome. Finally to get down and sit and talk with you. We've been going back and forth on LinkedIn quite a bit, but thanks for joining.
No problem, sir. And with that intro, I'm guilty hell of all of it. I mean, every bit. I can't deny, lie, or deny any of that.
And that's an abbreviated background for you, man. I'd love for you to just start us off, give us the nerd origin story, a little baby Chip. What got you into tech in the first place, and then where you got to today?
Everybody's got an origin story, right? Somebody had to get you into this field, right? As I tell, I've told this to students, I've told this on podcasts before and everything. I grew up dirt poor. I mean, just straight up po. Hell, we couldn't afford the R. I mean, we were just po. And I grew up in the Deep South, and I'm still in the Deep South. Probably because people make fun of my accent all the time, but I don't give a shit. But you know, as I tell people, growing up in poverty, you look for a way out of poverty. And yeah, it was a hard road for me. But about seventh, eighth grade, I got to see an Apple II in my first computer class. And wow. I was like, this screen, this green text, this is my out. I don't know what this thing is, but it's new and it's exciting. And I want to get into this. And my parents actually scraped up enough money to get a Gateway 2000 from fucking Walmart. And since I lived in a rural area, I didn't have a neighborhood. My nearest neighbor was a mile and a half away. I had the old dial-up U.S. robotics modem and the internet. And it was very new because, I mean,
BBSs, Usenet.
Yep, with BBSs and AOL and message boards. And as I tell us, like, you kids today are so motherfucking spoiled.
Oh, it takes too long to load up, Dad, or it takes too long. I mean, like,
what we had to go through to get stuff to work. We had to break it, fix it, and figure it out. There was no, like, the closest thing that we had in my town was a Radio Shack. there was no computer repair stores. And it was, you had to get your hands in it. You had to learn what this stuff is. And that's how I got started. And I went through my high school years, graduated with honors, got a scholarship, and went to college on scholarship because I busted my ass because I was like going, either I'm going to be really, really smart or I'm going to be really, really poor. Because the place that I lived in was cursed with high poverty, very rampant drug use. And it was one of those things that was happening in the South in the early 90s with the opioid boom that was actually happening, and the cases of heroin were going through the roof as well. And my dad worked very closely with law enforcement. My dad was a former spook. He worked for the CIA, NSA, NTSB, and then he ended up working for the ATF for about 4 years, and then retired out as a postmaster general for the state that I live in now. And he was, his job was chasing drugs through the mail. I got to hear a lot of that. And after we got out of a little bit of poverty to the beginning parts of middle class, to where we were able to, like I met cops all the time, met all these agents all the time. And every one of them said, keep your head in the books, keep your life straight. Don't get involved with any of this mess and stuff. And I had a very small peer group through high school that got me into college. And when I got to college, I was like going, all right, this is the time to shine. And while my friends were going out and partying and everything, I was in a data center. When they had the big IBMs, the big blues. And back in those days, you were the blue or red. So to give you a timeline, kiddos, this is in the early 90s when this was actually happening. And we started seeing for the first time, like Roadrunner, which was Comcast, getting DSL lines. And we went from, I'll never forget it, in 1996. It was like the trademark year. We went from 5 1/4 inch floppies to 3 1/4 inch floppies to zip disk. To jazz drives, and then for the first portable, I mean, the size of a lunchbox, 20 gig hard drives in 1 year with Toast, which most people don't even remember that program.
Oh my gosh.
So it was like, and we were burning the first 2 and 4 CD-ROMs. And it was a very interesting time to break into that industry because there I worked at a computer store that was a big box retailer called CompUSA. Which most people don't even know what CompUSA even is now that went away.
The CompUSA near me that I shopped at in college is now a Big Lots.
Yeah.
But I still remember walking in and seeing all those computers in the glass case up front.
Yeah.
Oh, man, you're making me nostalgic.
Yeah, and it's kind of a little bit of nostalgia now because, I mean, I started off as a bench tech making $12 an hour. I was like the highest paid bench tech that they had in there. And that's how I started getting like my first certifications. And I got my, like I said, okay, you have to have your A+ within 6 months. And I was going, what the hell is an A+? I didn't know what the fuck an A+ was. I was like, in college? They're like, no. This certification that you got to get from CompTIA, that's going to teach you what the insides and the guts of a computer are. I'm like, well, hell, I already know that. And then when I went to this, they called them Prometric Testing Centers. I don't even know if they're still around. But like I went in there and they put, take all the stuff out of your pockets. We didn't have cell phones. So it was like, just walk in there, give them your keys, sit down and then take this test. And it's like, I blew through it in like 20 minutes. And they're like, okay, you passed. Would you like to take the next one? And I'm like, well, what's the next one? And they're like, well, this is like your Linux plus, your network plus. So I'm like, that's how I started out. Cause like, I didn't know anything about certifications. I thought it was like, I'm going to school for a computer science degree to get my bachelor's. And then I'll be able to get a job after that. No. I found out very quickly that certifications build into the knowledge base of what it is that you have. And I took like the first Windows XP, like XP had just come out and we were on Pentium 4s and they were just kind of like, man, this is cooking with fire, dude. These things kick.
It'll never get faster than this.
Yeah. And then the whole Y2K scare back in 99 happened when everybody was updating. And this is where I was introduced to the first computer viruses. And I had bumped into a friend. He's like, yeah, we're going to this swap meet. And I'm like, what's a swap meet? He's like, we swap computer parts. And I'm like, fuck yeah, I'm going, bro. Let's figure all this out. And that's when I was introduced to the hacker community. And that's where I learned the roots. Because, I mean, coming from a rural agrarian state into a bigger city, like, I didn't know any of this stuff existed. It was how I was introduced to the hacker community and how I was introduced to the Linux community and what I call the dirty old wizards of the industry. Like, the guys that were there when COBOL was still around and punch cards. So it was very nostalgic and interesting to get learn these things and learn how these systems work and like how we got to the internet, like how we got from ARPANET. And this was stuff they were not teaching me at school. This was like all hands-on stuff. So it kind of blew me away. And I was kind of like, well, man, this is awesome. So I graduated summa cum laude and was still working at CompUSA after, and then Y2K happened. And then the internet, most people don't remember this, the internet recession happened. The Y2K bubble blew, and so did the dot-com fallout blew up.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody I knew got laid off, like everyone. And I was just paycheck to paycheck, hand-to-mouthing it, living in a one-bedroom, one-bath apartment, and just trying to keep my car up and running. And I scattered the world. I covered the city with just resumes and went to hiring companies and temp companies. And they're like, dude, we got nothing. I'm like, this is a fallout like you have never seen. And I went to my dad in a desperation. I said, Dad, look, I did what you wanted me to do. And I did what I wanted to do to get out of poverty. And I'm not going fucking back. And I'm eating top end ramen noodle with Gatorade and green beans to survive. And I'm eating. And when I get a really good paycheck and I splurge, I get some freeze chicken and put it in my George Foreman grill and I put mayonnaise on it so I can have substance for protein. And I'm like, I want to go in the military. And he was like, fuck no, you are not going in the military. And he goes, I got enough business cards with military contracting companies that I can make some phone calls to. But you will not go in the military. Because, I mean, that was, my dad had been poked and prodded by the Viet Cong and tortured and was POW MIA and got released. And he's like, look, I've gone through the federal finger up the butt. Trust me, it's not good. I know you're young and you're struggling, but there's more money to be made out there than going to work for the military. And I said, okay. So my dad made some phone calls and it was a month before September 11th. And then September the 11th happened, and then all of a sudden, military contracting became the biggest thing. And I got my military contracting license, and I had to go through all the background checks and everything. And I went through, finally got my license and stuff for military contracting and whatnot. And the first phone call I ever had was really a company now that's changed, but they were called Blackwater at the time. It was beginning part of my 20s, just 21, 22. And they said, oh, you're young, you're healthy, you got all these certifications in your license. Come in, let's talk. So
you're uncorrupted.
That is correct. Well, I had grown up around enough cops and DEA agents and FBI agents and whatnot. Like, I know the story, and I know, and my dad had tons of Marine Corps friends and Air Force friends and Navy friends. Like, I know the speak, and I know how the wheel gets greased and turned in the machine. Went in and they got my weapons training and they gave me a gun and pointed me towards Afghanistan with a laptop because I was the guy in the rear with the gear. And they said, once you get in country, we're going to assign you to a military unit, which they did, which they assigned me to the 501st Air Cav out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Great guys that I worked with. And I was attached to Special Forces Night Stalker. So that's how I got started in the industry. And they're like, well, wow, you know Linux? I'm like, yeah. Like, you know Windows systems? Yeah. You know all this stuff? I'm like, yeah. And he's like, well, cool. I did that for the better part of 15 years. Everything from training to teaching to seminars to counterintelligence. I worked in special operations. Then they sent me to Fort Hood to work with the drone program. And then after I worked with the drone program, they sent me to the Department of Defense, which I spent a year in that filing cabinet. And then my contract got switched to the NSA. The contracting company I was working with was getting some heat and some shit. So they sold my contract to Dell. And I was stationed at the National Security Agency with Joint Cyber Command, as well as Satellite SATCOM Intelligence, which I worked on and created a counter-surveillance, counter-intelligence program from scratch that started off as a sheet of paper with some crayon markings at Olive Garden, which turned into ship-to-shore satellite relay system and counter-surveillance, counter-intelligence drone software. And I got the patent for that, which was pretty cool, which I'd never had to go through that process, which Dell was hacker for that. Worked in the DevOps, and I worked down in the Rock, which is the lower bowels of the basement of the NSA. Then they sent me back to Afghanistan. And then I was shot twice, stabbed three times, and hit with an IED. And I was like, what? It's time to get back to the United States. So I came back on the end part of that contract to deal with narco-terrorism. I was like going, what? They're like, yeah, well, they need counterintelligence and counter-surveillance for narco-terrorism. But it's in the States. And I was like looking down and had my liver sticking out. I was like, nurse, can we tuck that back in? Because I'd like to get sewed up and get these bullets out of me. I'm getting a little old. I was in my late part of my 30s, going in my 40s. I was kind of going, like, getting shot at's not on my top 10 list of two anymore. So I want to go back to the United States. And they said, okay, we've got this contract, but you're going to be investigating the Sinaloa and the Juarez drug cartels for 2 years. And then I said, I am done. It was 2008. We just had come through the horrible Great Recession that was out of that. And so it was 2009. I said, what? I can do all this from home. I built my own data center and server room here in my house, which is the top level of my house on the second floor. I took the spare bedroom and hollowed out the closet and put in a rack server and air conditioning and airflow system and bought a ton of laptops and computers with some of the money that I had saved up. I've been working remote since 2015. So I was social distancing before it was a fucking thing. So, yeah. And being handicapped, because I've had 7 major surgeries before and after the accidents that happened to me. I still suffer with a lot of neuropathy and physical damage that happened to my body. I had my last surgery last year. They got some more metal out of me and they put some more metal in me to kind of straighten things out, make things better. But that is basically the journey that I've had. So I have been in my house working remote on remote contracts for everybody from gas, water, light, electrical, to nuclear, to working with the contract that I have now, which is with the New York, New Jersey Port Authority.
That is a circuitous origin story, and I would absolutely watch 6 seasons of that on Netflix. I have to tell you, man, who would we cast as you?
As I tell people, one of my favorite actors, I don't give a fuck what movie he's in. If it's got Nicolas Cage, my ass is there. I'm watching it. He's crazy, but you've got to be nuts to go through some of this shit and go through some of the stuff that I've had to go through. I mean, it's just been insane.
Yeah, I think Nick Cage could absolutely capture that crazy. And he is at the point of his career right now where he can do whatever. And you have already burst the parental warning that I might have had on this episode. He could do whatever the fuck he wants at this point.
He's made his money.
I think Denzel Washington for me. And I think that's just my insecurity. But anyway, I would love to dig back into a little bit of that background, because eventually, ultimately, what you've worked your way up to is sitting between the technology and the decision makers and the leaders. We chatted about this briefly before we started recording, is really you've gotten into a position of using your great wealth of experience to tell stories and make recommendations. And I think that is really what's of an interest, because given your background, you've got the technical chops. Oh, yeah. 100%. I don't think anybody can doubt that. But it's challenging when you have those technical chops to be able to put it in front of, say, leadership.
I try to say it this way. I put it in front of Joe Bierkant, because when I'm sitting on the stand having to explain to a jury what this pedophile did and how he did it, they don't understand a shit about PSEC. They don't understand network translation. They don't understand backtracking. So I try to, with the C-level people I have come, it doesn't matter who or whom you're talking to, they're what I call a one-pager. They read one page with the bullet points. They want to hear the 30 minutes of good and the 10 minutes of bad, and then go on to the next thing. Same thing when I make PowerPoint slides. I don't make more than 10 PowerPoint slides, because after that, they start thinking, shit, did I leave the damn my coffee in the microwave this morning? I mean, they start wondering. And it really has turned into psychology. And it's not that I'm a scary person. Yes, I'm a very scary person. My wife will tell you the same thing, because my husband is not nice. He is somewhat civil, but he is an asshole, but he's my asshole. So that's my wife would explain it. So
he is not a tame lion, but he is good.
Yeah. And truly in life, I have learned, especially when with the business, as I tell people, especially on my side of the fence, if you just learn to truly just not give a fuck anymore, you are truly free. Because like I go in there and I tell them the truth, and they don't want, sometimes they don't want to hear the truth, But if I sugarcoat the truth, it's a lie. And this industry, all of cybersecurity is built on one single thing. And I stress this every time I talk to students and whatnot, is trust. It's like, look, you got to trust me on this because I'm going to tell you how bad is going to be when this goes awry. And I'm going to tell you what a nation state would do to destroy your network and your systems and steal your money. I'm going to tell you, Mr. Banker, how bad it's going to be when they steal your bitcoins or they steal or break into your unregulated monies that's being transferred through wire transfer, white plastic, whatnot. So, I mean, yeah, it's like I can lead you to the door and I'm going to open the door and show the hellscape that is. You're either going to walk through it and fix it or you're going to close the door and you're going to forget about it and it's going to get 10 times worse. And then my rate's going to go up because they're going to charge you more. So it's like, you know, you pay me now, you pay me later, still got to fucking pay me.
Yeah.
And that's how I've approached the rest of my career since I turned 40. Because like there's life before 40 and then after 40, as I tell people, it's like, so once you go over that hill, I just quit. It's like, look, I mean, I have burned lean tissue in the night trying to bypass an ASA firewall and show them how bad is within their network and their systems. But it's like, is it going to get fixed? Yes or no? If it goes into a budget, when is that line item going to get pushed through? And when are they going to get it looked at? If it's a capital project, if it's over $2 million, we're looking at a year for them to be able to get funding to be able to do that. But are they going to fix it right now? The answer is probably going to be no, because a lot of operational technology, first off, is not cheap. And then on top of that, it's 30 years old. And for all listeners that are out there, OT technology stands for operational technology. Operational technology is everything from hydroelectric power, dams, electricity, coal-fired plants, nuclear power plants, ship-to-shore satellite relay systems, telecom, your lights. You flip your lights, the lights come on, right? What happens if the lights don't come on to your city? What do? You call the power company, right? So I deal with a lot of those things that are on that side of the fence that most people don't think of. And I call it the world under the world. What you see the surface of the world, but you don't really see the in-depths of how telecommunications, power generation, steam, water filtration and stuff work. You just turn the faucet on and get a fucking drink of water and go on with your day.
Yeah.
You don't think about the process of what it takes to get it there. And so, be clean.
There's so many things that need to work. I think a lot of people coming into tech now, they're like, well, I'm just worried about the network, and I can transfer my skills from a bank, OT, here and there, different industries. But you have to come at it with a real understanding of the business and the pipes to understand that I may be recommending this solution or I may be waving a flag over here. But like you just said, you have to have that recognition of your audience and what their priorities are and say, this might not be the thing that gets the attention. But if it is that hair on fire, how do you get someone's attention besides they should trust Chip if Chip says something? But when you're up against somebody who either isn't hearing just because they don't understand, or you can see that, okay, maybe the tech is flying over their head a little bit. What's your approach to crafting that message for that one pager? I love that phrase, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, they're looking at bullet points. I mean, it boils down to simplicity. Okay. And, one of the things that I watch a lot of documentaries, and I watch a lot of the 30 on 30 sports documentaries, like what players have to do to get into that zone. And it's never complicated. We overcomplicate the shit out of this industry. I mean, we really do. I mean, and especially right now in the cyber world, the buzzword of the year is artificial intelligence. Shit, artificial intelligence has been around since the 1950s, 1960s. This is nothing new. Artificial intelligence is not going to change everything and make everything better. It's just a tool. And then before that, it was what? Cloud? And mm-hmm. Then before that, I mean, we hear this in our, the IT circular industry and vendor industry and the things that we have to deal with that's coming from us, they overcomplicate a lot of this stuff because guess what? IP translation's pretty much been the same forever since it was created. Modbus, same way. It's 1970s technology and it's improved a little bit, but it is what it is. And it's not going to change anything. It's going to stay the same. You might ask them, it's like this. You got to have the cupcake before you put the icing and the sprinkles on it, right? And most of the time, people want the damn sugar on top with the sprinkles, right? They don't give a shit about the cupcake. It could be their vanilla. It could be chocolate. It could be strawberry.
who cares, right? As long as it's there. That's the key thing, is you got to build the core part of that, the approach. And that's what I do. It's not that I dumb it down. I'm not saying these people are stupid. I'm not saying they're uneducated. Hell, make a lot more money than I do. But my job is to come there and want to say, okay, here are the facts. And the simple part of those facts are, if this goes off, this happens. If this goes sideways and you don't have a DR plan or you don't have redundancy, this happens. This is what you lose. This is your downtime. And downtime in the industry costs money. Not just a little money, a lot of fucking money. And most people don't realize that. When an electrical plant that's generating gigawatts for a city and gigawatts for infrastructure, I mean, you're talking $400,000 an hour. That's all. I mean, you're talking $500,000 an hour for a power plant to be offline for an hour. So if it's down for like 4 or 5 hours, I mean, and they've got to prorate their loss, that's a lot of money that you lose. And that's also for operational downtime as well. And that's preventative maintenance, patching stuff, working with the vendor to get something solved. So it's a nightmare. I mean, because you're going to lose some money. And most of these companies don't want to lose money, you know?
Yeah.
And OT, when I tell students they want to get into this, they want to get into IT, they want to be like a red teamer, they want to be a hacker. I'm going to tell you right here and now, you are looking at a very hard road to plow. That's how I say it. You're going to be poor for a while. Don't think that you're going to graduate from a college or have a bunch of certifications and think you're going to get a six-figure job. You might, if you're top of your class, become a SOC analyst. It's pretty, because you got to pay your dues like everybody else did. And just getting a sheet of paper that says that what you're doing doesn't mean that I'm going to unleash you on a keyboard and a mouse to regulate a nuclear power plant. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you got to pay your dues behind the keyboard. You have to be able to click something. And I look at students and I said, okay, I'll give you an example here. Because I normally have somebody that's pretty cocky and they raise their hand. I'm like, why are you getting into cybersecurity? Oh, I'm getting in for the money. I'm like, what? There are a lot of other ways of making money than getting into cybersecurity. Not saying that we don't need you, but we'll give you an example. And that cocky student normally says, okay, well, give me an example. And I say, okay, here we go. You walk into work after you've parked your car, you get on the elevator, you've badged through and everything, you sit down at your desk and everything. The CIO and the CTO show up at your little cubicle and they say, hey, we've had a security breach. Within the next 30 minutes, I need you on the phone with all the different teams. I need you to start pulling packet information and finding out what happened. What do you do? And I said, like, okay, where do you go? What tools are you using? How are you going to be able to do this? And I asked the student that. And then they start crumbling and I start seeing them list. And I'm like, okay, what's going to happen is within 30 minutes, you're going to have no information and data based on what you've just told me on how you're going to be able to handle this situation. You're doing better basically to shit your pants, suck your thumb under your desk in the fetal position, and hope and pray they don't come and fire you the day of.
I guess it's very much like the military. Once you have busted that student down, what are some of the techniques and things that you use to stories that you tell them to bring them back up or to give them the reality? Because I was that SOC guy. I did the 12-hour, 8-to-8 shifts in a NOC, and it weren't for me. Don't do that anymore.
Here's the thing is I've been very blessed on some of the positions I am, because like right now I've got my team that's working on an issue and I'm watching the stuff go through Teams as we're talking here. And it's just so funny to me. We try to explain to them what they want, even with snapshots and pictures with arrows pointing to it, and they still get confused. It tickles me to death. And after I've torn somebody down and they're doing this, like, this is what you're really going to have to look at. Here are the certifications that you're going to have to need, and this is what you're going to have to do for the first 5 years. For my team, you must have certain certifications. You must have, keyboard time, like clicking time, and show progression in what you've learned and what you've done, and then admit what you don't know. Like, I am not a network engineer, and I am not a developer. I have a developer that's on my team, and he can speak Java and Python way better than I can. I admit I'm a script kiddie. Same thing. I am not a senior level network engineer, CCISP or Cisco or Palo Alto or whatever super genius whiz. I still have to use an IP calculator to figure some of those things out. I can't do that shit in my head. But the guy that works for me and everything that is in a Norwegian black death metal cover band that has long black hair and purple tips and tattoos on his chin and multiple piercings on his face. And looks like Henry Rollins meets Glenn Danzig meets Arnold Schwarzenegger that works on my team that you will never see on a video call. He's really good at it because, you know, he's from Norway and he's really good at doing that stuff in his head. That's his role. And know your role. Know what you're good at and know what you like to do. I will not take on a greenhorn, somebody that's just graduated from college that thinks they're some whiz bang hacker. I know you like, you have to have 5 years hardcore experience before I even let you get into this, what I do in the OT and the IT cybersecurity world, because guess what? You can get killed and you can kill people very quickly. And I was impressed when I met with HR last year, and I was kind of scared and impressed at the same time. I'm allowed 12 people to die on my watch before HR gets involved.
Holy crap.
When I get to 11, I need to start really kind of getting scared. That 12th person gets killed, it's on me, right? And then that's when I get HR getting involved. I'm like, okay. But I mean, that is the truth and the reality. And when I started this job, we had 3 people get killed. And then last year, I had a very good friend that got killed because we deal with cybersecurity at the zero level, the device level. So like we're physically touching the stuff. So, and when that stuff breaks or that stuff blows up or explodes or there's a pipe that ruptures and everything, there's human casualty that goes with that. So when you're dealing with OT cybersecurity, the first thing that should come out of your mouth is safety. Everything spawns out of safety. And we want to make sure that you are safe and secure and going on your life and that you're not paying any attention to what it is that we're doing behind the curtain. We want you to be able to get from point A to point B. We want you to be able to make your phone calls, turn on your water, flush your toilets, take a shower. We want you to be able to turn on your power and not even think about it, right? You just pay the bill. For example, when I worked with the RAND Corporation and I worked with Safe Harbor Industries, which is owned by Richard Dick Clark, who I worked under, who was like the grandfather of cybersecurity and the internet under multiple administrations. Everything that he taught me comes out of safety. It spawns out of the safety and the security of people, out of the safety of the nation, because like we wrote up these horrible reports that we gave to DARPA. Like if we took out the East Coast power grid, what the hell would happen? I mean, like you're talking the fucking purge within 3 days. I'm serious. When you're looking at no gasoline, no water, no light, no electricity, no internet, no telecom, people get feral really quick, like really quick. Like what's mine is what's yours is yours. And if not, I'm going to take it. So it is the nature because of how we are as alpha human beings.
Impressing that story upon people. I mean, I would imagine you do have a common understanding when you're briefing somebody or you're going in that they understand what's on the line as well. Now that you're doing a little bit more social media, public writings and things like that, and you're carrying a lot of that with you, do you think that's a story that needs to be told?
Yeah, it does. Because let me give you an example. Look at California right now that's burning down to the ground. They didn't have water coming out of pumps that were there. That's scary shit. That is a failure of infrastructure at the maximum level. When a firefighter goes to with a fire hose to a fire hydrant, where shit is burning all around you, there should be water. It's like, I'm going to tell you now, I can expect any time that you have a natural disaster, even the same thing that happened in the Appalachian community that's around in my area in the South, they're still recovering. It's going to take years, if not a decade, to get all that stuff fixed because you've got to replace power poles, lines, water lines, hydrants, maybe that are working or not working, sewer lines, all that stuff has got to be reconnected and checked. And people don't think of that. And they're going to be able to rebuild very quickly. No. On the most expensive real estate in the world? No. There's price gouging. And then you got to find out the people that are, how are you going to take that many people that's in that area that have lost everything? I'm talking fucking everything. And house them.
Yeah. My brother's in Asheville, North Carolina. Thankfully, luckily, he had just moved out of an area that got pretty damaged. But yeah, speaking with him, And I think it gets back to the storytelling. It's the narrative. I mean, you have the perspective of what actually is the impact, and a lot of other people try to capture the narrative and point fingers and make things that there aren't in what happened, or cast blame. And it's like, we just got to get to brass tacks and get things fixed.
Yeah. And that's where government comes into, this is your taxpayer dollars at work. That's what I tell people, right? You know, and it's hard for people to comprehend that, but you need government. Most people are like, oh, I don't want government involved in all this. Disaster relief like FEMA, which I work very closely with on a lot of things to get some of their systems back up. Like, for example, telecommunications. People didn't think about in the California fires, like, wow, what if all the data centers burn up that are out there and all the telecommunications lines? I mean, that affects the ability for people to fight the fires, for people to be evacuated, for people to get notifications there's a fire in your area. So people don't think about a lot of those things. And I tell people, this is where you need government. This is where I kind of forged the narrative, because I am not a very political person. I always say the prior administration and this administration, because I'm kind of, you know, pseudo-anarchist in a way, you know, on how I look at government. But, you know, I am bipolitical. They're like, what do you mean bipolitical? I blame fucking all of them. They've had 30 years to fix this shit, and guess what's happened? Until it blows up and explodes or burns down to the ground, and there's death and dismemberment that's involved, people don't pay attention to that until it happens. And that's the problem with a lot of the stuff that we deal with in cybersecurity. Some of the things we deal in healthcare, a lot of the things that we deal with in the bank industry. We're a very knee-jerk reaction society in the United States, and we're not very preventative a lot of times when it comes down to major infrastructure projects. Because, I mean, first off, it takes time, money, and a lot of people to do it. It does spawn jobs, but how does cybersecurity spawn out of that? Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, depending on what it is. There's not a lot of cybersecurity that's on bridges, but we need bridges, right? But we do need bridges that when they have barges and stuff that goes through there for monitoring systems, camera systems, all that. Those are OT technologies that are added to it, you know, because we don't want those things to fail, and we don't want something to happen like where you have a huge, gigantic cargo container slam into a bridge, and now people for the next 5 years have got to drive halfway around the town to get to work. And I was up there when dealing with all that, and people got killed. You had five people that were just doing their damn job, repairing the bridge,
yeah,
dead, straight dead. I mean, I was like, holy crap, dude. But, you know, we just got the funding passed, and now we're waiting on Congress to release the funds before they build a new bridge. And then they got to fight about architecture and zone coding and then reconstruction. And, I mean, the list goes on and on. So, I mean, this takes time, and it takes effort, and it takes energy, and it's not a quick fix, and it's costly. And, you know, time is money. Don't get me wrong, it is. And a lot of people don't want to pay attention to that, but it's true. It's very true. And nobody is doing this for free. I'm not. You're not. And in my world, no one gets into this industry with a little bit of villainy in their past.
Yeah.
As I tell these stories, I'm like, there's no good guys in these stories, including me. You know, I'm like, I am not the good guy in most of these stories that I tell people, you know, or I tell stakeholders or shareholders, is because a lot of the stuff that I'm telling you, it's, you know, if I'm doing it, it's pretty bad. If it's really bad, if I get successful hits on some of those things. And a lot of companies now, they just want somebody to check the checkbox on the list and say they did it for their annual cybersecurity training or their testing. Those days are long since gone. You know, we can't do that anymore. And we have to get better and improve on our industry. And how we do that is we mix it up. I am all about hiring minorities, women, anybody. It's like, if you got a human pulse and you want to get into this industry and you really are dedicated and want to do it, I am your biggest fucking cheerleader. I mean, I manage five guys that's on the SOC that's on my side, and I work with high level shareholders in the C level every day. And I'm really good at it because I explain to them in no really terms, this is what you're going to be doing. This is what you're going to be dealing with. Here's the hellscape that can happen and so forth. And people say, well, you're a very scary person, Chip. Just what you know. It's like, no, I'm a very scared person. I reverse that on them because it's like, if I can do it from my house, Imagine what China could do, or the Russians, or the Iranians, or a hacktivist team. I mean, this is, we are now an AI that targets that system. I mean, that's made specifically for hacking, cracking a system and tearing it down and taking it down. We're dealing with 30-year-old technology. It's not that hard. And a lot of it's vendor owned and operated. So if the problems that are with Schneider Electrical or Bosch or any of the other manufacturers out there, and they're security holes, and you do your research and you find a water treatment facility, yeah, I guarantee you can probably get in there if you put the time and effort and the team on it, the right team, the people that are looking for problems in the exploit of the code, the people that are looking for the wireless network, people who are looking for tethered devices in the system, or like some places down in Florida, they've got TeamViewer open to the world to where you can just, oh, that's fine, I can just remote on in. So it's very scary, and I can scare people with some of the stuff that I do, and they get very defensive. But I tell them, like, if we do fix this, here's the fun part that happens. It's the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very important to put certain people, especially when you're, I don't want to talk about like high pressure sales, but when you want to put someone in a position to pay attention to what you're saying, to give them a sense of pressure and then release that pressure. I mean, I'll tell you, man, it sure sounds to me like you are still in the thick of it. I'm curious about what you personally do to decompress or to step away from some of this stuff. I work with a lot of founders. I work with a lot of devs who are like, technology is my life. And I'm like, that's cool, but you're not a machine. So what does Chip Harris do to keep things fresh, to re-energize and juice yourself up maybe at the end of a rough day?
Well, yeah, I am a father. So I have a 12-year-old half angel, half terrorist that I have to take care of, because every day in my house is a fucking hostage negotiation. I mean, it's like 24. Sometimes I feel like, you know, it's literally, I have to deal with her. And then I have a wife who loves me very much. We're about to have our 18th wedding anniversary. So she knew what she was getting into when she married me. I was like, honey, this is the reality of what I do. And she goes, I love you anyway. I'm like, okay.
Famous last words.
All right. I'm on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I'm not going to be able to go to sometimes some of the events that happen in my life. And it happens. And I understand, and they get what it is that I do. And they kind of, I'm not saying they walk on eggshells around me for what it is I do, but they know what I do, and they know, and I see some really evil, bad things that most people wouldn't even dream about. I mean, it's like a demon's resume. Most people would never, ever think of these people could do these certain things. But if you're dealing with what I deal with, you have to kind of, when you're talking about decompressing and dealing with a lot of the things, because I mentally see a lot of evil stuff, everything from crimes to murder to drug trafficking, human trafficking, child pornography. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Also, I deal with smuggling rings and distribution of high levels of narcotics, opioids, through everything from our shipping, but rail trains, automobiles. I mean, I deal with all of it. So what I do to decompress is I play Warhammer 40K. I'm a huge, gigantic tabletop gamer. I've been playing Warhammer 40K since 1994. I love tabletop miniature battle games. I've been doing that because I like the hobby aspect of it, because I like to paint and airbrush. And I've done airbrushing on Harleys ever since I was a kid, since I ever picked up an art or airbrush. And I've done West Coast fine lining on stuff, back on vehicles, helmets, cars, fenders, you name it. And I really enjoy the hobby aspect from what I learned doing from static models. Because, I mean, it's like you could always back in the day go back to Walmart and buy like a Sherman tank. And I loved gluing them together and painting them and putting them on my shelf and everything. And that just, and then when I got into tabletop miniature battle games, I was like, oh, cool. I get to paint up the toys that I, put on the shelf. Now I get to play with them. So, I mean, yeah. and it's fun. So Henry Cavill and I are rolling dice, because he's a big 40K nerd. So, and he's got the 40K universe that's coming to Amazon, just like the Lord of the Rings stuff. So I'm looking forward to that. And I played in tournaments. I played on the tournament circuit for a while because at the, as I tell people, at the end of the day, 4 o'clock, when it comes the end of the day, it's my time, my time. So I stop. I mean, I try to stop mentally and I try to stop physically, unless there's something major going on, and stop and say, okay, now it's time to go. Now it's time to go be dad. Some dad time. Cause my kid is the coolest fucking toy on the planet. I fucking love hanging out with my daughter. She's great. She's awesome. I brag on her all the time. I like seeing and hanging out with my wife, and we're doing home improvements through the house. So I got that to do. But if my phone rings, that flip, that switch, it happens just like that. Now I have to stop what I'm doing and go upstairs and figure out what the problem is. When I travel, I have to take my work laptop with me. And I've got two phones. I've got a regular phone and a burner phone. So it's like, it's kind of like a double life in a way. But when I explain that, it's like, look, I get paid for 40 hours, and then, but sometimes I work 90. Sometimes I work 180 hours in a week. And they're like going, how the hell can you do that? It's like, because I've been doing it forever. I mean, I've been doing it since 1994. But now that I'm getting older, now I have a team of people that can help me do that. So instead of being this thinking that you're this one-man army hacker that's going to go out there and do all this whiz cool stuff, no. You're going to be part of a team. And you need to know what your role is in that team. And I hate using this business speak like, what's your swim lane? I hate that crap. But it's like, you've got to find out what your specialty is and what you're really good at and what you like to do in this industry and hone in on that and don't stop. I mean, and the money will come. As I tell people, don't be greedy. I deal with greed all the time. People try to steal stuff. And greed will get you in the end. But there, it's a progression of steps that you're going to have to take through your career to get to the point that I am.
What's some of your favorite personal projects that you've worked on?
One of the first things I did was with Idaho National Labs, been declassified. I worked on Project Aurora.
Oh, my God.
And so we took a diesel electric engine and they unleashed us on it to see if we could blow it up. And we used pneumatic pressure to blow up a diesel electric engine. And a diesel electric engine is what you see in a train. So imagine a choo-choo train that you see on the train tracks. Take the engine out of it and hook it onto the internet, and yours truly and about six others, we blew that motherfucker straight up to prove the point. It's like, look, some of this stuff doesn't need to be on the internet, period. And all we did was turn it from off to on, off, on, off, on. That's all we did. And there's videos. You can go to YouTube and look at the experiment. And it took us, and a diesel electric engine, it's not like you can go to the hardware store and order one of those, because the lead time is about 6 to 8 months for the parts and the engine. So imagine all of those that are hooked into a hydroelectric dam, which most of them are plugged into, that you shut down the water supply for a given area during the summer. So that's kind of like the hellscape, and that's watered down. I mean, that's really watered down conversation that I have, because people are like, can you do that? I'm like, yeah, it's relatively easy if you know how the SCADA systems work and how the vendors work and you know their vulnerabilities and just fucking go for it.
I was actually working at Constellation Energy in Baltimore when y'all did that. And boy, I'll tell you, the guys in our SOC were puckering when that news dropped.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, and it was a cool project because first off, they came to us. We didn't come to them, you know, and they were scared, like going, okay, how bad can bad be? And we're like, dude, we can unleash pure nightmare fuel if you want. And they're like, yeah, let's do that. Let's just do it like a black hat, do it like a nation state, and let's just see how far you get, you know, and they put their software on there. And their air quote, I use air quotes when I say this, cybersecurity resilience program on it. And then they put it on the open internet. They just gave us the IP. And after that, it was, let's start using our evil tools, most of them that are open sourced, and our knowledge between six people. And it took us about 30, 35 minutes and we were in. And it's like on, off, on, off, off, on. And then boom, it's gone. And if you're an OT like I am, like, this shit could kill someone. I mean, this could be really bad. And that's what sticks with me, because this is on the ending of how bad can be. One of my best friends, this was last year, because, you know, I'm allowed 11 people to die under my watch. It's kind of weird. saying that, but, you know, one of my best friends worked with him for years. He was down in a building that was, they had done some change outs of the steam boiler, but they were working on some PLCs that were on the steam and trying to get the calibrations right, because the device was saying one thing, but, you know, guess what? The steam that comes into the building and the pressure was saying another. And he plugged into the PLC. He plugged in his laptop, got into terminal, which I hope you kids know what command line is out there, or PowerShell, and used Telnet. You know what that is, kids? That comes out of your laptop with a Cat5 cable into the machine, and got into the GUI and everything and saw that the pressure was going up way too high. And it was actually being misread, and he pulled it down. And when he pulled it down, it pushed it back up and caused pneumatic pressure and caused the pipe to burst. And this is a 4.5-inch steam pipe. And if you've ever seen a hot dog that has been burned on the charcoal grill a little too long, that's what happened to him. Because he was in a closed room, yeah, and he boiled to death. Now, that is not good. You know, there's good and not good in my world, and that is not good. And when you have someone that gets killed on your watch, it sits with you. It sat with me for a while, and I was like, going, man, Steve was a really good friend of mine, and I knew his wife, I know his kids, I've known him, you know, years from hacker conventions and stuff, and stuff that we had done in the OT world, and stuff we had done in the oil industry on oil rigs and everything. And he was a very safety conscious person, but that was something that was due to the manufacturer, you know, and it was their settings that were wrong, and they had to take the blame for it. They had to pay for ADD. It was accidental death and dismemberment. But I would much rather have him around than the money. You know what I'm saying? I'd much rather have my friend, yeah, that has been a friend of mine for years and years and years. I know he would love to be with his wife and everything, than them getting a certain amount of money every single month because, you know, her dad boiled like a hot dog for 10 minutes in a room that he couldn't get out. That's agony, that's pain, that's death and dismemberment. Yeah. And just knowing that that sits on the backside of, hey, this could hurt, this possibly could hurt and kill people, that really changes people when they really look at OT systems. You know, because when I tell that story, it's like, that's the truth of what you're dealing with in my world. You know, and it's like, if you really want to do this, trust me, we need you. We need 250,000 people in OT right now. 250,000. And I don't see the educational in the industry pumping out that many people right now. And take on top of it that you're having to train these people for 3 to 5 years.
I mean, it's a tough story to tell, but it's one that's got to be told. And, I think we should all appreciate just in what you've been able to tell us and share with us how important this stuff is. What advice do you have for maybe that technical person that is maybe on the cusp of realizing they've got maybe a couple other, I'll call them soft certs, that they need to pick up? Yeah. Where do you think people should start?
So I'm two generations of poor white trailer trash tornado bait. I tell people, if I can do it, you can do it. Okay. It doesn't matter if you are black, white, Asian, hot pink, purple, plaid. Color does not matter to me. Whether you're male, female, trans, or, you know, whatever. I don't care. As long as you're not violating a child or a goat, I don't give a damn. I really don't. Is you can do this. And I work with law enforcement and I work with agencies, a lot of them three letter. And I work with the state of New York and New Jersey, which I love them. So, I mean, they have some really good people, really smart people. But sometimes you have to cut through bureaucracy and red tape, right? And you need to know how to talk to people. Know your audience, right? Know whom it is that you're talking to in those soft skills. You know, so if you do have the ability of taking public speaking, if you do have the ability of writing speeches and writing something down, because a lot of the stuff that I deal with has to be documented. So spelling matters, words matter, grammar matters. And if you can't functionally write stuff down for people to read, and I'm not a vocabulary Nazi or by any means whatsoever, because I speak good English and bad English, and mostly a lot of bad English and cuss words that's involved with it, but I don't write that down, even though I'm saying that to myself in my head. But you just, it's like, how do you explain to somebody they're stupid without saying they're stupid? You know? So how do you say, you need to do this without telling them you really need to do this. So that it's not what you say, it's how you say it in those terms and those words. And the thing, though, too, is know their problems, because they wouldn't be coming to you if they didn't have a problem. During the interview process, I'm going, so what's your biggest problem? Why am I here? And this throws them off guard a lot because they don't want to admit that. What is it you're trying to do here? They don't really don't want to admit that. What is your plans for me if you bring me on for what you want me to help you do and fix, right? So you need to get you, when you're interviewing them, they're also interviewing you. Does that make sense? I reverse it on them. And it's like going, okay, I see that you want OSINT and you want all these other certifications. Are y'all going to pay for those, or do I have to get those within a certain time frame? Do y'all have a budget for my training that I have to do? Because I have to keep certain CVEs as a professional a year. Are you going to pay for me going to B-sides? Are you going to pay me for going to DEF CON? Are you going to pay? My guys have written in their fucking contract during DEF CON and Black Hat, they're off. Like that whole week, they're gone. Like they're in Vegas. And the thing, though, too, is what was great about my job, when they made me kind of the head of OT and cybersecurity, I hired all my friends from DEF CON and Hacker Cons from years. People I've known in the industry, I was like, hey, man, you want to make an extra side money, some moonlighting money versus your normal job? It's about 35 hours a week. You don't get any benefits or anything like that, because I know that you're working a job that already has that. And I hired my friends. So like, these are people I've known for 10 to 15 years, in the hacker community. Some of them that I've never met, some of them I have met. But, I got them hired on to work under me. And it's like, I let them do what they do best because they know their role. I've got one guy that's a developer. I got one guy that's a network engineer. I've got one guy that deals with phones and cell. I mean, he's great at hacking cell phones and OT equipment, radios, frequency warfare. I mean, he's really good. I've got another friend that deals with just nothing but dealing with vendors and vendor patching, mitigation, and holes and stuff that he can find within those, because I'm trains, planes, automobiles, including World Trade Center and the Statue of Liberty. That's my role to protect. And my last guy, who's in Rockland, New York, he is great. That motherfucker has a 99.999% social engineering score. He can get in, he can con his way into anything. I mean, he is that good. And he deals with a lot of my counterintelligence and counter surveillance warfare. And I'm the kind of de facto leader that leads these guys into a campaign. And it's not that we're doing red teaming, because we do have a red team. I'm not in charge of that red team. But do we use red teaming, blue teaming, and purple teaming skills for everything that we do? Yeah, because we are not stuck in one, thing, because we deal with all of it. Not just some of it, all of it from different parts of the business. And that's including networking, that's including documentation, that's including meeting with legal, that's including meeting with law enforcement. I mean, we deal with a lot of different shareholders and stakeholders in my team. So you've got to be able to communicate. You've got to be able to talk. You got to be able to document the process. You've got to be able to do PowerPoints. So those are some of the soft skills that I tell people, because I get paid a lot of times to go to these meetings and listen. And I pick it apart. I'm really good at figuring out what it is that they're saying, but what they're showing me is not what they're wanting to do. We need all the staff. We need all the software and vendors. I'm like, no, you don't. You just need one thing. You need one or two things. And it's simple. It's easy. It's affordable. And guess what? Most of it's already within the network or within the system anyway. And we've already got the approved vendors and whatnot. You're basically picking up while you're sitting on the toilet a copy of Redmond and reading this and thinking, oh my God, Jesus Christ, we need to have all this stuff because the invaders are attacking us and the meteor's about to hit and we're about to become extinct and we're not being progressive in the environment. No, you're just getting scared to death, because that's kind of what we do. We either focus or fold. And I try to keep them from folding. I'm like, you need to focus on this part of the business. What you're trying to do, what you're trying to say is this, but the real meaning behind it is this as well. They get confused because we have in this industry, I call it the glittery kitty syndrome, okay? And the glittery kitty syndrome is this. They are hyper-focused on trying to get this one thing done, and then they see the glittery kitty over when they take their blinders off for the day and like, ooh, look at that glittery thing over there that I want to be brought into my environment. And they don't think about that, like, what's the implications to networking? What's the implications to OT or IT? If I take this glittery new whiz bang sugar on top kind of thing and put it in my environment, am I opening it up to more attack? You know, am I making the attack surface bigger than what it should be? Right. And we're now seeing this a lot when we were, you know, talking about artificial intelligence. When I started this conversation, because a lot of the stuff that I talk about is about AI and what AI can and can't do. So as a student, you need to know how that works, right? Because that is going to be a technology. It ain't going away. That fucking bullet train has left the station. And we're all on the ride. IT and OT, everybody, guess what? We didn't want this, but we got it because vendors shoved it up the ass of a lot of companies. So we're dealing with AI now at a level that we didn't really think about 10 years ago. You know what I'm saying? It's changed dramatically. Even 5 years ago, as I tell people, if you don't know what Moore's law is, that's right out the window. I mean, it's gone.
Absolutely.
When I saw the NVIDIA conference, when it was streaming and they showed a $3,000 machine that's coming out, that's a Blackwell processor, that's basically AI in a box. I was like, I fucking want it. I don't know what it is, but I just want it. For some reason, I'm compelled to spend $3,000 for that. It's like, I want that box that's got the most high-rated processor on the planet with a terabyte of memory I could dump into it with a built-in AI engine. I don't know what I would do with it, but I just want it. Like that.
Once it exists, then you've got to get your hands on it because other people are going to have their hands on it.
Do you think the evildoers are not going to buy the shit as well? I mean, come on. I mean, think about it. Yeah. So, yeah, as I tell that, and that's part of the thing is that that's part of my job is to do the evil stuff. But then I have to go, okay, what do I do to prevent the evil stuff as well? You know, what are the good practices? You know, what are the OSHA? What are the laws that are affiliated with this? You know, the 852, the 853 series. We use the bow tie model, you know, for everything, you know, that we do. So it's like, you need to know what that is, you know, and then you need to know budgetary concerns, like how much is this shit going to cost, you know? And then, you really got to know and have those lines of communication, as I tell people, and extend those olive branches into other parts of the business so that you know what's going on. Because if you don't, you're going to get left behind. And I'm not saying you're being nosy or anything like that. It's like everything that I do daily runs on information and the truistic form of information and data that I get. Now, sometimes it's wrong. Sometimes it's right. Sometimes it's kind of lukewarm. They're saying one thing but doing another. But you know, that's part of the business. Is that my job is to figure, you know, that out.
So I guess if I would summarize that single piece of advice, it would be learn to talk good, make friends, pay the fuck attention,
and sometimes shut up. Shut up and listen. Shut up and listen.
And shut up. What exciting projects are you working on now? What's Chip got in the closet that you're working on? That's real fun. Maybe keep the death and dismemberment to a minimum.
Well, hell, I try to. I'm working with two friends of mine, and an AI to write a book. That's one thing that we've got cooking this year that we're thinking about. We're working on. Like we've got some OT stuff that we want to talk about. 90% of what I deal with is classified. And there's double NDAs and SLAs. So a lot of this that I tell people, like, yeah, I'm going to do a tell-all book. But we're approaching it a different way. And we're going to use artificial intelligence in a good way. We're in the process of making it and programming the data logic and the pool and the transformers and the transistors to be able to talk about stuff that civilians will understand. And people that are in our industry that will understand, that will be able to pick up a book and read about it and go, wow, that's some crazy situations and some crazy cool stuff. But it also has a happy, what did we do? What did we learn? What did we see? And then how did we do it? And how we're kind of approaching the book and the chapters that are in the book. Because a lot of the stuff, all my stuff has to go through the Department of Justice and the DOD. Before I can even talk about it. One of the cool projects that we're working on right now is dealing with AI and OT systems. The sneak peek that you get behind the curtain that I can actually talk about is there's always people that are out there that are gonna make fake personas, you know, And there are people that are out there that can do voice hacking or voice translation or translation hacking that can take my voice and make it sound like me to talk to somebody else for phishing campaigns. And a lot of what we call whaling is when you go after CEOs, VPs, stuff like that. So we're working. We took what was happening on the IT side that we saw with those things and translated it into OT.
Yeah. I love the little glimpses that you're able to share with us on this. Where can people follow you, get engaged? I mean, obviously, you keep a pretty tight OPSEC, but I know you're on LinkedIn. I can put that link in the sure. show notes. But if people want to keep an eye on you and the projects and stuff that's happening,
well,
where can
they find
you?
Well, that's the fun part. I can only post on because of the situation I've been in the past, you know, and for your audience to know, I've been hunted by the Chinese and the Russians. They put a red notice, an Interpol red notice on me to try to have me deported one time. They've doxed me twice. I've had to move twice because they were afraid of something physically happening to me. And when I got doxed by the Chinese, I mean, they really went deep. I mean, they stuck that knife in and turned it really hard. They went after my mom, my dad, my wife, my kid, me, my aunt, my uncle. They went after everything they possibly could to dox me. They swatted me even twice. And it came straight from China because I tracked the IP back to Kuala Lumpur, right to the what we call the Great Firewall of China. And I was like, yep, PLO did that, you know. The People's Liberation Army, that's who swatted us and who did this and whatnot. And I showed that to the government. They're like, okay, pick a place to move because we're moving you in 3 days. I mean, like literally I had to pick up my entire livelihood and move within 3 days. So I'm allowed Facebook and LinkedIn. That's about it. You know, so, and where I live, you could see a terrorist a mile away. So I at least have some time to fire off some long range shots here at the house because we are armed to the teeth in this house with guns and lots of ammo, and country boy here can survive. So it is what it is, but that's really the only two platforms I can communicate on. I try to do a lot of podcasts. People know that what I'm doing, I'm a reoccurring guest on a lot of different podcasts, just so that people can kind of keep in touch on what's going on my side of the world. It's kind of evil, but it's there. I'm with the evildoers and I kind of explain a little of those things that are going on. And also this year, I made it a point to do a lot more conferences and speaking engagements. Like people fly me in, which is kind of a little expensive, and put me on the stage and everything with the mask and all to talk to people. It's like, this is for the reason why I'm around. This is the reason why you have people like me. You don't like it. You're not going to like what you see. And a lot of people don't like what to hear, but somebody's got to say it. Somebody's got to be the adult in the room. So, and somebody's got to be the fucking bad guy. So I have no problem playing any of those roles.
We are glad to have you on our side thinking about all the bad shit. It's been a blast, man, since we last did a really quick chit chat. I wish you the best of luck. And I think everybody can benefit from hearing from the trenches about what it really is to do this shit, but then what it is to have to talk about it, because it needs to be talked about.
It does. And that's why I have people like you, you know, people I've contacted, you know, in the industry, people that have followed me on LinkedIn, you know, and they've been in my network. And it's scary stuff. You know, it's not not for the faint of heart. But if you know, and anybody in your audience that is listening to me, trust me, it can be done. You know, you can make a great career out of this. You really can. You're going to have to make some sacrifices, actually a lot of sacrifices. You know, and you have to give up a little bit of your humanity, sometimes your sanity, from what you're going to see and what you're going to get. But it's very, very beneficial to me to know that the world that I'm making for my daughter, you know, and for the populace and for the United States that I love so much is more safe and secure. But the problem is, you pay me now, you pay me later, still got to pay.
And with that, we will... sign off. Chip, thank you for joining me.
Thanks so very much, and you have a wonderful day, sir.
Thanks for sticking with us. I know this was a little bit of an extra long episode, but Chip is just a fascinating guy with a lot of interesting information. I just wanted to say thank you to everybody who's listening. This is episode 10, and as of episode 9, we passed 1,700 listens, so I know y'all are out there. You could do me a favor and jump into my socials or drop me a message at joel@messagespecs.com. I'd love to know what you think, and if you have any great ideas for guests, topics, please let me know. I want to make this useful to you. Have a great week. If you want links to the resources mentioned on the show, head on over to the episode page. And for information on booking a message therapy workshop, getting your hands on the message deck to check out my upcoming book, or just buy me a coffee, go to nerdthattalksgood.com/podcast. Remember, you don't have to speak well, you only got to learn how to talk good.